Okay, we're here today to interview Professor Timothy Jonathan Entwistle. My name is Dr. Kate Cregan, and it is Thursday, the 28th of March. We're in Tim's home in Glen Iris, and the purpose of the interview is to be included in a much larger oral history project that's been run by the Australian Garden History Society. So, just to start out, Tim, I'd like you to tell me a bit about where you were born, when you were born, and your sort of family background, if you can, please.
I was born in Nil, so that's in the Mallee of Victoria, and that's on the 17th of June 1960, but only spent a couple of years there. My mother, Betty MacDonald, and father, John Entwistle, were both teachers, so they moved around. We moved from Nil to Wangaratta to Euroa, and so I would spend a few years at each of those places. But I have two brothers who are Rodney and Colin, and they, of course, moved with us between those places. And until 1966, when John Entwistle, so my father died of asthma, and my mother looked after the three of us for quite a while, particularly in Euroa, we'd got two by then, and then remarried when I was 10 years old. So she married Ron Wren, and also joining us were some extra children. So we had an extra. Well, I had an extra sister, Juliet, and I had three older brothers, Jonathan, Chris, and Tony. So then we eventually moved back into Melbourne at that time. We moved to Alphington and lived there for quite a while, and then eventually moved back out into the country again to live at Castlemaine, where I did my final years of high school.
Okay. Must have been a bit odd going from being an eldest child to being a middle child all of a sudden.
It was a, I suppose it was difficult in some ways initially, but I was fairly independent and I'd been looking after, I think, the two younger children with my mother, or like to think I did. And when we got to the new arrangement, the three older brothers were just old enough to be sort of living almost separate lives. And Juliet, who was a bit younger, blended in more perhaps with the younger cohort in that new family. So yeah, it was a big change, but for whatever reason, I think I've been fairly adaptable, and I don't really get too fussed by those things.
Right. And was gardening a part of your life then?
Absolutely not. It's interesting thinking back, and I have a few times thought about where the interest in gardening came. And in those early homes, they were rental properties, not very flash. There's no gardens that I remember really. I do remember some early gardens, but they were very basic, very dry. I remember most of the places seemed to be, with dry plants and not being particularly well looked after. The biggest influences, I think, in terms of gardening came when my mother remarried, and so Ron Wren was interested in growing seeds and growing eucalypts and gums and local plants. He was a bit of a field naturalist, I guess, was his interest, but he liked to grow things. So there was that connection. And then also my grandfather used to take us for walks in the bushland around Castlemaine. He lived there as well. And I recall those connections with the local bushland, not so much gardens, but I suppose being out in nature. So they were there latent, and then I moved on through life and got interested in other things, but there was certainly not a strong gardening influence in my early years.
Okay, so you say you went bushwalking. Would you say that you had an interest in nature then rather than gardening?
Yes, as an adolescent, as in my 20s, there was definitely an interest in what we might call nature, so not ornamental gardens. And I definitely enjoyed bushwalking up to a point. I had an ill-fated bushwalk into southwest Tasmania, which meant I really got put off long bushwalks because it was very unpleasant and didn't enjoy it too much in the end. But I still like doing day walks and 2-day walks and going out into nature. So I think that connection for me is more about plants more generally than it is about, you know, amenity or ornamental gardens, which did come later.
Yep. Okay. Yes, I have read about your adventure in Tasmania, and I have to admit, I do wonder what drew you to going for that particular bushwalk.
I think it was, in a way, not thinking about it too much. I mean, I went there with friends who were keener bushwalkers than I was, and we were university students who didn't think much about all these kind of things, so we didn't prepare very much. It looked exciting, you know, people loved this walk, which is in the Western Arthurs, was known to be quite beautiful, so I thought, look, it'd be a lovely thing to do. What I hadn't thought about, I think, is how difficult it might be, and it's an interesting thing, sort of looking back on it. I did enjoy parts of it a lot, and some bits spectacular, you know, it really was a special place. But because we got stuck in a cave for, you know, four days or 5 days, and we had to sort of, we ate all our food, so we had to walk out. The stress of that was, you know, I realised that wasn't a great deal of fun. So I avoided doing longer walks again. But I think it's more, I did things as a student where I would just do them without thinking too much. I don't think I necessarily planned it at all.
That was, so you're in Tasmania and that would have been the early 80s. Were you at all interested in the sort of protests and the conservation and Franklin River and those sorts of things going on at the time? Because it was around a similar period, wasn't it?
Yes, I was. I was interested. I had friends who were involved in living in Tasmania, involved in the No Dams movement. I was strongly involved in more the uranium or anti-uranium movements, and particularly in North Melbourne when I used to work there. So I was very much connected with those. I didn't actively go and protest. That was not, and probably all through my life, I've not done, you know, I've been on protest marches and that, but I wouldn't call myself an intense activist wanting to be put in jail for it. I would tend to do the intellectual stuff and I'd write about it. I would, you know, write letters to people. I'd join groups and I'd help them. So with the Southwest Tasmanian changes going on, the damming of the rivers, I was very much against that, and I would contribute to meetings. I would sort of talk about it and write about it, but never actually found myself in the river, so to speak.
As some people did, yes, yeah. Okay, so moving on to, because you've already sort of started to bring it up, your university experience and when you did become more focused on plants, how did that come about?
I was very interested in science, and I, from an early time, I think I felt like a scientist, and I don't know that I defined it that way, but I'm a very kind of logical person, skeptical, and I do find that's the way I approach life, so science suited me. I also found at high school that if you could do science or you could do maths, you tended to be pushed into it. And I've slightly regretted that a little bit because I had interests in history and a few other things, but you're always channeled into particularly maths and physics if you could do them. And I could do them. They were fine. So when I went to university, I picked the, you know, pure maths and advanced physics in first year. And I thought, this is the challenge. This will be fun to do. By the end of that year, it wasn't much fun. I didn't really enjoy it. And I'd done one little botanical subject in that year. And that botanical subject was really just done to fill in the number of points. So we had to sort of make up a year and I needed an extra subject. And I thought, look, you know, I remembered growing seeds at home. I remember that kind of latent interest perhaps. And I thought, look, botany could be an interesting subject. So I didn't do zoology. I did botany. And then after that first year, I changed entirely to botany, got rid of maths and physics, didn't feel I needed to do that, and then continued through my degree doing entirely botany. So I'd never done biology at school, except obviously as part of science, I guess, in early years. And I never did zoology at university. I used to argue, and this was probably part of my approach to life at the time, I didn't want to dissect animals. I didn't, there were things I did at university to avoid any. In physics, I wouldn't do the pracs to do with uranium. So I had sort of principles and things I would be willing to lose marks for, and I never did zoology either.
Okay. So you shifted your major to botany, and that would have been over 4 years for an honours degree?
Yes, it was, but it was over 3 years, really, and then there was another shift. And towards the, well, in the third year of the degree, I became obsessed with algae, microscopic organisms like seaweeds. And when I got interested in botany, I think it was the quality of the lectures, the interest, I think it was presented really, really well. When we got to third year, we had fantastic lecturers in algae. They were interesting people, they were cool, they were kind of informative, and I switched to doing algae, and then that I did a little project in third year, and that led to doing an honours year. So by the time I got to the end of my 4 year degree with honours, I was what we call a phycologist. So I was interested in algae. I'd transitioned through botany, and I now had got to what I thought were these amazing organisms called algae.
So you'd already specialised.
I had. You, in a way, you have to specialise, and in a way, you do anyway. So it could have been, I could have been working on Banksias, or I could have been working on something, a fungi or whatever. So for me, I got interested in algae, and that was, again, coming back to being a scientist, there was things to discover. I went out collecting and found some algae in streams. I brought them back, look under the microscope, and they were new. They hadn't been seen before, and it was that excitement of finding things that seemed to be unknown in the scientific world, and that I found quite exciting. And I became what we call a taxonomist. So I identify, I name and classify plants and algae, and again, that probably fits my personality quite well as well.
Yes, I noticed that in your memoir, talking about being a taxonomist, that you actually are a bit of a not a rebel exactly, but that you have taken issue with the sort of a level of colonialism that's inherent in taxonomy that goes back to 15th, 16th century, probably, initially?
Yes, probably more so in recent years. I think I was probably blind, to be honest, I think I was blind to that when I was first doing taxonomy, or not, in a sense, not blind is perhaps the wrong word, but it wasn't, I didn't quite see that dilemma or contradiction. In more recent years, I can, and also, you'll notice I'm very careful to say things are discovered for science or it's a scientific discovery, but of course, these plants have been there, the algae were always there, sometimes known to First Nations people, sometimes not, but they're always there. Just because a taxonomist or someone like me comes along and puts a name on them, they don't suddenly come into existence. So I've always, that probably is my own interest. The other one that goes alongside this is probably a slight philosophical interest in science, and I've often read about the philosophy of science and got into these big debates, as you do probably when you're a student, about what's a species and how, what does that mean, and that takes you, I think, into some of these places, because you realize to a degree these are arbitrary constructs that we're setting up. But then you also look for ways to make them less arbitrary, in a sense, to make them have some scientific integrity. And during my career, that science of classification has greatly changed. When I began, it was more like, as people sometimes describe it, stamp collecting. You're popping names on, putting them in boxes, and there's no way really of knowing whether that means anything. By the time I finished, there was a lot more work being done on the evolution of organisms, plants, algae, and everything. And trying to relate shared characters and look for shared ancestors, and you know, DNA sequencing came in, and all that combined, as much to do with theory as it was just in the new techniques. But it did mean that we have a much stronger basis for the way things are classified, which means, without getting into a whole separate discussion, the way we now classify plants is hopefully more realistic and more predictive and tells us more about things. And that's why often we have name changes too. People get irritated because we split things up and change them, but now at least there's a rationale for that.
Okay. So when you finished your degree, you took up a job at the, well, first at the box factory, or the printing factory.
Yes.
Cutting up boxes. But when you got your first research job, that was at the RBG, is that correct?
It is. I had an interesting sort of connection with the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne, or Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria, as it ended up being called. And I did work there after my honours degree. And when I finished, I wasn't quite sure I wanted to do more research. And I wasn't, and in fact, working at the box factory, as you say, which was my wife Linda's parents ran that factory. And that was biding my time in a way until I got a postdoctoral project that I'd put in, or I was hoping to get at the time. But I even after honours, I was really unsure whether I wanted, this going back to honours, whether I wanted to continue in research or wanted to kind of go out and do something, I don't know, just, you know, do something, perhaps get some money and enjoy my life and those sort of things. So I did decide to take a year off, and that year I spent, or 9 months of it, at the Botanic Gardens as a horticultural assistant, which is kind of odd because I was a phycologist, as we've talked about. I did a bit of botany, but I did work in the gardens for this 9 months because I wanted to and I enjoyed it. And I had, you know, thinking back probably to the little trigger for that, I'd worked over one summer holidays pressing and plant specimens and labelling and mounting them, as they say. And that was a holiday job to get money because I needed each year to get money for university. And 1 year I went to the gardens, and I think that's where the little sort of spark of liking the gardens or working in the gardens came from. Spent this 9 months there, then went off and did a PhD on algae. So I decided I would go back, and I remember talking to people and thinking, I may as well, I'm going to do something. It's going to be algae. It could be, as I said before, it could be Banksias. It could be working on something entirely different. You know, it might have been the history of the Roman Empire, which I would love to work on. But I decided to do that, and then that you know, sort of became, I suppose, once you become an expert in something, you do continue, you find out what's needed, and that led to that eventual postdoc when I was in the box factory, printing factory, and that postdoc was on more the ecology of algae, which was interesting. So as someone who loved classifying things, I then had this more practical project about why algae grow where they are in the Yarra River catchment, how we might use that to help us talk about water quality, how we might monitor. Deep down, it was an excuse for me to still go and collect and classify algae. I think that's what was still driving me, but I had, you know, that had a practical value.
Okay. Is it correct that you did your PhD in a relatively short time frame?
I think these days it would be considered relatively, or those days, relatively short. It was three and a bit years. It was always going to be that. I think I was sort of the view that you can always do something in a set time. I mean, I think if you set a kind of, and I do this through life generally, you set a kind of time frame and you do as much work as you can. I very quickly realised the PhD could go on forever, and it was really up to me to kind of define what it was. And I think the other thing is I do get sick of things, and while I enjoyed doing the PhD, and I should point out I went from Melbourne University where I did my degree to La Trobe Uni, and that was because there was a good supervisor there, and I quite liked going to another university, a bit of a change. I found by the end of it, I'd had enough of that. And eventually, I think my career, when it gets into Botanic Gardens, a lot of that is driven by not wanting to do the same thing all the time. And I'm not, I freely admit in my memoir, I'm not a particularly good scientist in a way, because I just can't focus for that length of period. Science is mostly 90% just, boring, tedious collection of data, and I can't do that.
That's interesting. Do you think, and this is a bit of a side question, do you think you would have prospered in an academic career then? Or do you think you took the right path in going towards working in, it's not really industry, but it's outside an academic world?
Yeah, I often thought about that, because every now and then I thought I might go back into academia, and I think it was always a possibility, and I probably initially thought that's where I'd be. I think what I would do if I was in academia, I would the lecturing and the other parts of the work, and a lot of academics, of course, will do research, lecturing, and they may have some other side hustle that's related to their work. And if I did algae, I might get involved in environmental projects where I was the algal expert, if you like. So I think I could have made that work. I do think, looking back, it was a good change for me, and working in industry, as you say, or working in a botanic garden, and eventually becoming a CEO, or eventually having a role where you can talk about and lead and make decisions, but also not be sort of tied to the minutiae of detail, suited me far better. I think a university career would have worked as well. I just would have had to think about the way I structured that.
Okay. So we started to move into your working life. And I guess one of my observations about that is that, as you say, you were a CEO. What doesn't come out in your memoir is, what's it like to be a CEO day to day? Like, what are the kinds of things that a CEO of a botanic garden has to do? What are the decisions you have to make?
Yeah, I think the reason for that not coming out is that it's very different. I've found, if I talk to other CEOs, it can be a very different role wherever you are. And for me as a CEO, I've always liked the fact that you can run at a whole lot of parallel levels, if you like. So I can go out and I can do an opening of an event and give a public speech. I can write about a particular botanical topic. I can go and give a talk to a plant society. I can then come back and sort of be involved in the budgeting of the gardens, and I can start to plan for how we're going to do things. So the day-to-day of being a CEO is actually really hard to describe. And I remember giving a talk a couple of years ago, and I was talking about a typical day as a CEO, and I just couldn't think of what it was like. In a way, it sounded like I did nothing. On one hand, you sit there and you think, well, the organization would work entirely well without you. And I think, to be honest, as a good CEO, it should be something very like that. You should be there like the conductor of an orchestra. They can all still play their instruments, and they could, in a way, play the tune, but you're there holding the whole thing together. So when you are doing it well, you're not getting down into the detail, and you're able to sort of skim across various bits and pieces. But for me, a typical day, perhaps a bit different to some others, was because I was an expert in my field, and I'm just meaning in a technical sense, I'm a botanist, I wanted to do some of that botany at the same time. So I would maybe start the morning by writing something. It might be a piece, an article for something, and then when I get to work, I might deal with have meetings, but in between those, and even in a 10-minute break or a half-hour break, I might go back to some other piece of work that is slightly more intellectually challenging, and that's creative. And so as a CEO, there's the duller stuff, and then there's the creative stuff. Some CEOs, it would be all about the business. For me, it was mixing that, running the business, with being a figurehead for a cultural organisation. And I like that blend, that you have this, I think I've sometimes described as a soapbox where you can use as a director, but you also have to do the technical detail. So it changes. And the unpredictability, the fact you can't describe a day, is what I like.
So the kinds of, you say, meetings, that's something that I would project onto that job, that it would be full of meetings. What kinds of meetings would you have to attend?
Well, you have meetings with your staff. So you would have meetings with your executive team. You have meetings with your senior leaders. You'll have meetings about a particular project. So you might meet with a couple of your staff and you're about to put on a big event, and you'll meet with them, talk through the logistics. So often there'll be a series of meetings first and it comes up to you. Then there's external meetings. So there'll be meeting with, you know, what we love to call stakeholders these days, but meeting with people who you want to work with, or people that you need to influence, and this might be with the City of Melbourne, or it might be with a government minister. So there are those kind of meetings. There are meetings with the parent department. So, for example, at Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria, there's an environment department that changes names every now and then, but that's where you sit administratively. So there are meetings to do with that, catching up with the deputy secretary of the department, or catching up with somebody who might be looking into your budget submission for that year. So the meetings vary. As anyone who works with me would probably know, I don't like meetings particularly, and I would try to avoid having meetings when I could, probably to an extreme sometimes, because I'd prefer to just kind of make decisions and have a short meeting. I do get frustrated by meetings that just go on about nothing. So I tried to not do those, but inevitably you have to meet. I thought maybe I could get rid of them all, but I never could.
No. So all the places that you've been in these high management positions, so that would be the RBG, then Sydney Botanic Gardens, then Kew, and then back to the RBG, is that correct?
Yes, so it's beginning at Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria, then moving up to Sydney to the Royal Botanic Gardens and Domain Trust,
yep,
where I started as a head of science. So when I was first in Melbourne, I was a botanist. I got a job there after I'd been doing all this algal work. I got a job as a flora writer, and that meant, you know, writing up accounts of flowering plants, back to the Banksias, and other things, and ferns, and all kinds of things. And I loved that because I felt like I was being paid to be a student and studying new things. I thought that was, you know, an amazing job. And it also got me then interested in plants more broadly. So when I first worked, it was the Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria, it was a botanist. But I then started to move up through into sort of head of research or research manager there. And then the job came up in Sydney as what was called director of science. And that seemed a big opportunity, both career-wise, but also a chance maybe to move. I quite like, you know, trying different things, and this is an opportunity to do something else. And I should mention, I got married along the way to Linda Martin, and we had two children. I don't know if I should bring them up at this point or not, but that influenced those decisions and how far we moved. So we weren't going to go overseas, but moving to Sydney seemed quite reasonable. Jerome, who was born in 1988, and Emily in 1989, were an age where we sort of moved them into primary school. So we went to Sydney. I went as head of science, and then an opportunity came up to be director there. I'd been acting for quite a while in the job when the director was away, so I always liked that, you know, doing that role. And then eventually the director was there, left, Frank Howarth, and I acted for a while and then applied and got that role as director of Sydney. And Sydney's it's a very big, it's probably the biggest botanic garden in Australia. And it has a strong science group as well, which I quite liked, and three botanic gardens under it. So I worked there. Then a job came up at Kew Gardens in London. That was a big shift. And in that case, we had to leave our two children, Jerome and Emily, they were quite keen to stay in Sydney. They'd already found their homes there. They were at university. They were happy sort of outside. I think they were both living away from home by then. So we thought this would be fun. Linda was a French teacher, so she was interested in being closer to Europe. I think that had some appeal. It was a chance to sort of do a bit of travel and, you know, an adventure. So a bit scary, but an adventure. So we took this job up, and I was director of I was director of conservation, living collections and estates, which is a very odd kind of title, and it effectively meant about half of Kew Gardens. It was cobbled together to run different parts of Kew, and Kew's a huge place. It's 800 staff and a huge budget. So I had about 400 of the staff, and I had these bits of horticulture and landscape. I had the Millennium Seed Bank, which was a big venture, conservation programs. I looked after the old building. So it was like being a mini director. So that's why it was not, you know, even though it wasn't director of Kew, it was an opportunity to do something similar. We worked there for, we lived there for 2 years in Kew Gardens and enjoyed that experience immensely, traveling in Europe, traveling in the UK. And I enjoyed the job there a lot. And then the directorship came up of Kew Gardens, which I applied for and didn't get. And that then set me thinking about what I would do next, because I perhaps always hoped or thought maybe, going to become director of Kew would be a lovely, lovely thing to do. And for all kinds of reasons, it didn't happen, which is kind of fine. But then the role came up back in Melbourne to be director of Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria, a garden I loved, a garden I'd been brought up in, I started my career in, and the director there had been there for 20 years. So I thought, if the next person might be there for another 20 years, and that might put me past my viable life as a director. So I did apply and was successful, and we came back to Melbourne after just under 2 years in Kew. So we weren't there that long. The plan was always to come back at some point. It wasn't going to be a forever job, but the 2 years was much shorter than we expected. We didn't get to every country. We didn't get to every place we wanted to travel to. But I did come back and then spend 10 years.
So each of those institutions would have been at least partially publicly funded, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Did they all also rely on bequests or philanthropic monies as well?
They do. In fact, they're slightly different mixes, but each of those gardens would have money provided by the government coming a certain percentage of the budget, and then the rest you would provide through your own earned revenue, and that could be things like cafes, it's things like events, philanthropy, sponsorships. Kew Gardens was only about 50% funded by the government, and they had an entry fee. So they, you pay to go to Kew Gardens, as you do in a lot of overseas gardens, and that's part of their revenue. Whereas in Melbourne and in Australia, all the botanic gardens are free, and the subsidy is much higher. So the subsidy in Sydney, if you call it a subsidy, was maybe 70%, 60%, 70%. In Melbourne, it's more like 80% the government put in, and the rest you would provide from these other things. In Sydney, there were more options. There was the domain, which was around the outside of the garden, you could use for running big events, and Sydney Festival used to run in there. They had a car park, in fact, that they ran, and had car parking. So there were more revenue sources. And then in Melbourne, a lesser mix, but still having that combination.
So are those public funds directed in particular ways? So would some of it have to go on infrastructure or have to go on research? Or
not technically. I think in the end you often run the budgets with that in mind. So you do sort of think, these are the core activities we must do, and the more we can raise from external money, the more interesting things we can do, the more, the more educational things we can do. In reality, I don't like to view it that way too much. I do see, and I've always seen, the cultural elements of the gardens, the scientific elements and the conservation elements as equally important. And I don't like to think, we could just run the gardens and close the gates, for example, and people wouldn't come in, or we would just, look after the collections. I don't think that's what a botanic garden is. So in the end, you tend not to put a dollar against, a dollar isn't directed towards a particular, so government money is not directed to a particular area. When it comes to the crunch, you often do have to talk about it that way sometimes to government to explain, and certainly say that you're putting a certain amount of money into certain areas. And if you have to make cuts, usually there's a discussion with government about where those cuts are made. And that is because it's a public organisation, because it's a cultural organisation, and essentially you report to a minister through a board. Those decisions have to be made in consultation, so you're not totally independent as the CEO.
Yeah, I should probably clarify that In Australia, we're talking about state government funding, aren't we? Do you get any? Do the botanical gardens get any federal government funding, or is it left completely to the states?
They're primarily funded by the states, except for the Botanic Garden in Canberra, which is funded through the Commonwealth Government, and all the others are funded through the states, or in fact in Brisbane, funded through the city the council. So there are different models, and there are, and regionally you find some gardens funded by councils, some funded by departments of government. So there are different kind of funding sources. But yes, in Australia it's mostly the state government funding, and for Sydney and Melbourne, definitely state government funding, with research grants often coming from the Commonwealth. So some of the botanical work would come through Commonwealth grants, like a university, and you're competing for them with universities.
So the equivalent of the NH and MRC sort of grants?
Yeah, and ARC and various grants, yeah. And often, you know, they'll be done in combination. So with a university, you would tend to put in grants with the Botanic Garden and museums and universities together and employ staff at each place.
So would a lot of the research at each of the Botanic Gardens that you've been at be done in collaboration with universities? How much would be in collaboration and how much, or even industry, how much would be purely funded through the garden?
Yeah, that's changed over time. I think when I began, a lot of the funding, for example, in Melbourne, was internally funded and the research was done almost independently. And I should say taxonomy is a field where people have often worked alone, which is unusual these days. You would work by yourself, studying a group, and do the work. And these days, of course, papers have many, many authors usually, and the many collaborators, which is, you know, generally a good thing. And that's changed over time. But I would say it could be about 50-50, but usually any decent kind of researcher or scientist working at the gardens would be expected to be bringing in grants from outside and be expected to be supervising students and be expected to be teaching at universities to some degree. So there are very few now who would not do that, and they, you know, they might have in the past.
So would they have partial positions in the university? Because I know that's how it can work with doctors in public hospitals.
Yeah, there are some combined positions. We tend not to, haven't done much of that in Melbourne. Some, Adelaide, I know, does it to a greater extent. There are pros and cons in that. Universities are very strong partners and they can dominate, and there's always a tendency in botanic gardens to be a little bit wary of those sometimes. But the reality is, and one of the, you know, one of the more interesting positions at Melbourne Gardens at the moment is a postdoctoral fellowship that's funded through philanthropy. Half the funds were raised by the university, half by the botanic gardens, and then invested, and the money coming off that, the interest supports a postdoc, and that person is based either at the as a joint position, as you're talking about. So it's done. Often, though, it's more like a position based or funded, if you like. So they're a public servant or public sector position through the gardens, and then they just get involved in research at the university.
Okay, internal research.
Yeah. It's interesting. There are so many combinations. We had a research group working on urban ecology for quite a number of years when I started the gardens, already going, but that was a combined, the Baker Foundation funded a lot of it, but it was based at the University of Melbourne. So the offices were there, the staff were there, a lot of them were employed by the university, and there were some staff employed by the gardens. So that was quite integrated, and that ended up finishing up just because the funding stopped.
And what about in the UK when you were at Kew?
Yeah, Kew, there are joint positions. A lot of people there would hold a professorship at a university, either sort of technically or as an honorary role. So my own professorship is an honorary position at the University of Melbourne, and that's done a lot. So a lot of the researchers at Kew in London would have connections with universities, and it could be Reading, or it could be Oxford or Cambridge or London. I mean, there are different universities, but they tended to have connections with certain universities historically, and they would... And if you supervise a student, I mean, the best way to get fresh people and fresh ideas, of course, is to be involved in some kind of teaching or supervision of students, and that would require some connection to the university as well.
Okay. So coming back to you as being a CEO or a manager in various different levels at different gardens. You've said in your memoir that you like to keep control of the message. You like to, put out a particular message about the garden, whichever garden you're working at. And it seems to me from having read the memoir that for you there is also a bigger idea that you have about what gardens should be and how they should function and how they should function in relation to the rest of society. Could you tell me a bit about how you developed that position?
Well, just if I could take one step back, you're quite right about that sort of controlling the message, if you like, and sometimes to I think the detriment sometimes. I realise that looking back, I was very much liked to have a consistent message coming out of the gardens, and I got a bit frustrated if we didn't do it well, because that media is something I like doing. I like being able to communicate, and I like to have a strong message. And so when I saw it weaker or not as strong, I would kind of maybe step in. So I did do that. The more you talk and the more you give talks, and one thing I've done all through my career is give talks to groups, and that can be, you know, mentioned before, plant societies or field naturalist clubs or probus groups, whatever. I tend to say yes to those. And it's important to me to say yes as often as I can, and I like doing that. And you do find that when you give those talks, you have to think about what you can talk about, obviously. And I might talk about, the Botanic Garden itself, or I might talk about climate change, or I might give a talk about the history of something. To me, it always has to have an element of a slightly higher theme, if you like. I don't like just giving a talk where I'm just going to run through, the Botanic Gardens has 10 gardens, this is what they do, this is the event we do. I like to have a narrative. And I found that narrative started to develop, and that was around what botanic gardens are, what they can do, and why we need a botanic garden. And I found that quite an interesting provocation too, because I like that as well. I like sometimes when you can test people's assumptions, and even at big international meetings, I like to sort of test. I might go to a botanic garden meeting. We all think they're great. I'd like to test. Well, are we great? Why do we do what we do? Why do the government give us money? Why should they keep supporting us? And in the memoir, you probably recall, I did frame that in terms of, reading a novel that happened to sort of make a critique of botanic gardens. This is a book by Robert Desai, and I liked that particularly, and I did use that. So I use that a lot in talks, and I've done this in other things. I like a kind of a use that word again, provocation, but a way to test myself. And when I did that, I started to think about what a botanic garden was, and I was a scientist by training. I became very interested in the public side, the event side. I love a botanic garden that's engaging and brings people in, and that became very important to me. I don't see the point of a botanic garden that doesn't have excited, happy people coming in. I also realised we were doing lots of important conservation work. But I got a little bit frustrated by people tending to say, you need to be one or the other. And this would happen in kind of corporate planning meetings, coming back to not liking meetings. Ones I hate are corporate planning meetings, probably. And only because I love the big thinking, but what I don't like is you tend to have to say, well, what do you really do? We're here to save plants. And I would go, well, yeah, we are, but also more than that. And I'm comfortable holding multiple things at the one time, and I really do believe a botanic garden that's good does a whole bunch of things together, and I talk about those nature, culture and science. And more recently I've been just written something a few weeks ago about healing gardens, and done a few talks on that, about the fact that there's so many different ways we actually are involved in the health of people and the health of the planet. And that's quite a nice take for us to think about, comparing ourselves to hospitals, comparing ourselves, probably during COVID, I was starting to think a lot about this. What do we do in terms of emergency responses? What do we do in terms of helping the community stay healthy? And so, coming back to your question around what do botanic gardens do, I just felt that I developed these ideas and I would give talks on them. They change over time. But for me, it gave a broader theme to what I was saying. And to me, that's important, to have a bigger narrative when you're talking, not just sort of relaying the facts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, yes, you've called yourself a provocateur, or you're saying you like provocation, and I can read through the book, the memoir, that you like to be a bit of a provocateur. In relation to your work with the AGHS, how did you come to be involved with them?
Well, that's a good connection, actually, the provocateur and the AGHS, because, and I should add very quickly that I think I like to be provocative, but in a kind of gentle way, to sort of, you know, hopefully people, I'm provoking them, but not irritating them. And if I get that right, that's where I like to be. But the interesting connection is the first thing I recall, the first connection I had with Australian Garden History Society was back in the early 1990s, and the editor of the journal then, Richard Aitken, was looking around for some reason, I'm not sure why, but he was looking for people to review books. And I was always interested in writing, and this is probably a theme through my life, you know, I was a slightly frustrated writer, and frustrated in a sense I would like to do more of it. And I was keen to write these book reviews, or and I can't remember if he asked me or I offered to do it. So I started to write book reviews, and he quite liked them, I think, because I was you know, cheeky and always am quite honest. So I was never someone who would just write a book review and say, this is lovely. And I would always try and make the writing interesting, because otherwise I wouldn't write it. And I was looking back on one when I was preparing for this interview, and I was saying to Linda, it reads like I'm a pretentious git, in a bad way, but in a positive way, I was enjoying writing. You could see that I was enjoying getting into words. I was enjoying gently poking and provoking, and not just saying, well, this is a great book because it's about the history of gardens and it's a very worthy book. And I often tend to say something is worthy, but... so anyway, Rich Aitken seemed to like that, and so he would come to me with books and get me to review things that I didn't necessarily know much about. And again, this is probably a theme in my life. I like to talk about things that I know nothing about, and then within half an hour can become a sudden expert, then talk on radio. And I love that. I love the kind of excitement of that, because there's a real buzz in being able to talk to your experts in your gardens and then be able to convert and translate that. And then talk to me a day later and I've forgotten what I was talking about probably. But in those book reviews, I enjoyed it, and it was a chance. And that was the connection I had with the society way back then. The only connection, I think. I don't recall going to meetings initially. And I did that through the 1990s. This is when I was working at Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria. And I was into writing. I was doing a bit of writing for The Age and newspapers then too. So I was starting to try and write in as many different places as I could, so this provided an opportunity. So, you know, to be fair, I was probably taking advantage of them in a way, and as a chance to write. And that's how it started.
Mm-hmm.
But then I did end up sort of making various connections with people, and there are people in the society that I've crossed paths with and met through the Botanic Gardens, and people in Sydney, Colin Morris and Howard Tanner, Peter Watts, who is in Sydney. These are kind of people within the society that people know, and that I got more and more interested, I think, in that history of gardens. And also working in a botanic garden, you realise you're looking after these amazing heritage landscapes, and so there's obviously a connection between garden history and what I was doing in my day job. So I did start to go to meetings. I started to give talks. I was invited, I think, to give a few talks. And I spoke on, for example, Joseph Banks. You know, we're talking before about mixed legacies of people and about him as sort of starting the foundation of scientific botany in Australia, but also, you know, setting up colonial Australia and the big changes wrought there. So I found that an interesting contradiction, or to go through the history of the gardens, the need to replace trees. One thing I've spoken a bit about, and it all fed from a major event I talk about in the memoir, which was removing trees in the domain, some fig trees. Now, that was, you know, I can read about that in the memoir. I don't need to do a whole chapter on it, so it's too much already. But it was formative, both in giving me the courage to go out and speak on these issues, and also meant that I would then contribute later on into debates about looking at, you know, sometimes it's the right thing to remove a tree, and sometimes you need to think about the future, and a tree does need to come out. And these are hard topics, particularly within Australian Garden History Society, where we tend to think every tree is sacred or every garden is sacred. It gets me into ideas about heritage gardens and how to care for those when the trees die, when the climate has changed and you're going to have to put different trees to survive, when the design of the garden no longer exists, what did they think the garden would look like? I find those topics really interesting, and my own view on a lot of that is very nuanced, and you know, it's case by case. I don't have a kind of you must preserve a garden exactly how it was in a particular year. And that's important in botanic gardens because they're not created in one year. They're created over 176 years in the case of Melbourne gardens, and they change through that time.
Is that at odds with Kew's approach to having a very large historic garden? I'm just wondering.
It is and it isn't. I think if you look through Kew in detail, you find, you know, there's new children's gardens, there's a new Mediterranean garden. So in a way, they keep the bones of it, and they keep the heritage, and they have the lovely history that people love about it. But they are adding new gardens for exactly the same reasons. Their mission or their vision is to change people's lives, to conserve plants, and the only way they can do that is if people are interested and come there. So you do conserve the heritage, but in a way that it's a changing heritage, and it's quite subtle in some ways. But Melbourne Gardens is a great example. Or, you know, Cranbourne is different because this is the other garden I used to look at after as Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria. That's a newish garden within a bushland, but the Melbourne Gardens are, you know, a heritage garden with a very set framework of paths and gardens designed by William Guilfoyle. And I think it's quite beautiful, perhaps the most beautiful botanic garden landscape in the world. And that can be both good and bad. You know, you're constrained by that, so you don't want to ruin that. But equally, you have to keep reinventing and changing, I think, because you're a botanic garden, you're not there just to hold on to that historic landscape. And I think it's been done well at Melbourne, you know, before, during, and well after my time, in adding elements to that landscape that fit in but take it somewhere else. And great examples, the new arid garden, the cacti and succulents, or the volcano, as it's called there. These are elements that connect, they're still linked to the old garden, but they take it somewhere else.
Yes, I ask about Kew because having visited many National Trust buildings and knowing a little bit about their codes and listings, I wondered whether that extended into an attitude towards maintaining a particular idea of a historical garden.
It does. It extends in a legislative sense as well, because these are it's World Heritage listed, the Kew. Melbourne is listed state basis, I think, and that does constrain what you can do. So technically, you can't move the path, you can't make the path wider. This is Melbourne, and Kew's the same, you know, kind of got certain constraints. And that's reasonable. It just means that you work within those constraints. And certainly with Kew, while I was there, I was chairing their World Heritage Committee, and you work with the neighbours around the area because it's sort of a broader heritage area around Kew as well that's part of. And that does mean you need to look after the elements, the historical elements, you know, where the first garden was at Kew, near the palace, Kew Palace, look after some of those views and vistas. But like a building, you do your conservation analysis, you work out what the important things are, and they can be infrastructure or they can be less tangible things. Well, it's tangible in a sense, but the views or the feel of the garden or the landscape style.
Oh, like sort of you know, particular vistas.
Vistas are very important.
They've been designed 200, 300 years ago. Yeah.
They have, although I often comment that I think if you brought back William Guilfoyle, he'd chop down a lot of trees in the gardens because we'd stuffed up his views. Or, you know, when he planted, he would have thought, oh, I'll come back in 50 years and change this again. For sure.
Yes, well, that brings me around to another set of questions. Because the gardens, as you know, are built in an area that used to be a meeting place for the local Indigenous people before we arrived. How does the garden in both the Botanic Gardens and also the Sydney Gardens, how do each of those deal with that kind of history?
Mm. Yeah, that shared history or a combined history. It is something that's always in our thoughts and always a consideration, and you do it in different ways. There are, if we look at Melbourne, there are elements of that garden that have been restored back to the original vegetation around the river, so bringing back the Indigenous plants, and through that, using those to interpret local First Nations culture, the Wurundjeri, Wurrung, and also having a lot of educational tours that connect people to plants using local knowledge. So there are educational ways of doing it. And same out at Cranbourne as well. In Sydney, there is a connections garden there between the colonial first gardens around Sydney, which didn't work, versus the natural vegetation, which was full of things that people could have lived off and they didn't. And that's interpreted very strongly within the garden. So you do that kind of thing. And it's interesting, just new signage went in, or wayfinding, at the Melbourne Botanic Gardens before I left there. And that's got a really deep connection to the country, but not in a sort of berries and sticks way, as it was put to me. It's more, there are colours for the different zones of the garden. So the signage has colours for the highlands, for the meeting areas, for the river. And so embedded in the wayfinding is the cultural elements of that land before it was a botanic garden, without doing something like, you know, putting the berries and sticks and having a symbol of an Aboriginal culture. It's trying to, and we worked with local communities to do this. That was a preferred way of doing it. So it's still a botanic garden, but it has that deep connection. Now, there are many more things that need to be done at Melbourne. One of the interesting, it's not quite the question you asked, but one thing that interests me a lot before I left, and I was talking a bit about it, was sometimes people would say, well, why don't you return the botanic garden to natural vegetation? Why don't you return it to the plants that used to grow there? This is an old-fashioned idea, having exotic plants sitting in the middle of a garden. Shouldn't the botanic garden be turned back into the what grows around the river and perhaps the landscape that was there before the city? And I think it's a good question to ask, but my response to that would be I would knock down the art gallery, I would knock down the MCG, and I would put that vegetation there, and I'd keep the botanic garden because it's far more important than those places. So it's a misunderstanding of what Cripple a botanic garden is. Yeah, well, it's a misunderstanding of what a botanic garden is. It's not just plants. It's kind of saying, well, because they're plants growing in a botanic garden, it's the same as restoring vegetation. It's not. It's a cultural institution that does a whole bunch of other things, like the gallery, like MCG, like the State Library.
And obviously then there are attempts to bring in Indigenous culture as well, as you've been describing. is that part of the thinking behind Cranbourne as well? Is it a greater part of the thinking behind Cranbourne as well?
It's stronger at Cranbourne, partly because it's a newer garden. There's a chance to build it in a more integrated way, and there are, you know, talk about seasons, Indigenous seasons in some of the displays at Cranbourne, and the plant material and some of the signage there has a stronger connection. And because there's bushland as well, so there is 300 hectares of heathland, and that is managed as a conservation zone, but also because of its connection to country as well. So I think there's more that can be done out there, but it's designed, I suppose the theme of an Australian garden lends itself to, you would hope, to an Australia that goes back 60,000 years or more. It's not an Australia that goes back a couple of hundred years.
Yep. And within that, is there an exploration or a research or acknowledgement of Indigenous cultivation practices? So we're talking about gardening.
Yeah.
So rather than just, you know, it's an Indigenous Australian plant, the way that Indigenous people, Aboriginal people in Australia might have actually cultivated plants.
I think that will emerge. And because that's a concept that's probably got more profile in recent years, particularly through Bruce Pascoe's book and other publications, that idea of it, of agriculture of some form and the cultivation. But so the short answer is we don't do a lot of that at the moment out of Cranbourne, but definitely that is something, and it's being talked about, how do we best do that? Because to change a botanic garden takes a bit of planning and time and landscaping, so it would eventually. But it does bring up a related issue, which is about cultural landscapes and probably returning a bit, connecting to the Australian Garden History Society. There's been a discussion over recent years about the Australian Garden History Society being a society that should have a broader interest in cultural landscapes. It's not just about big old gardens of rich people, to put it bluntly. And it's about broader landscapes, it's about restoration perhaps, and that would connect up through to the gardening or the interventions by First Nations people. But it's also, you know, of course, as we know, the whole of Australia is a cultural landscape because of fire and because of people living here for so long. Interestingly, I began by sort of in this discussion within the society by encouraging, you know, us to think more broadly. I've reversed a little bit in recent months, and on that issue, I'm a bit worried we're going to have scope creep and our society will become the society for everything, because if you're the society for cultural landscapes, I do think you then have responsibility for, because they're all cultural landscapes, the north of Australia or southwest Tasmania or every piece of vegetation in the whole of Australia. And that's not quite what I think people mean when they're talking about garden history. So there's a definitional problem, which is a bit technical in one sense, but it's important because if the society is interested in those plants where we manipulate or we actually cultivate or we change, if that's the incentive, you can take that all the way through to the whole country. But then that becomes, you know, national parks, and it becomes a society that's interested in all kinds of other things that I think is not that productive, because you would end up having, if you're overlapping with groups that do that. So I can't see the point in that, but I can see an interesting point around where does garden history take you? And I think it takes you into suburban gardens. I think it takes you into the gardens of the less rich. I think it takes you into balconies, and it takes you into perhaps urban environments. And to some extent, gardening, when restoration is gardening, and some restoration is very strongly gardening, you know, the replanting of plants around the area where we live here, that's about gardening. It's about, and I think I can see that connecting to garden history. What I can't quite see is perhaps a piece of forest that is being or has been burnt for tens of thousands of years, but that's the, you know, what we would add as a society to that.
I suppose I'm thinking or asking more, is there research being done into what kinds of practices that might be recognised as gardening by non-Indigenous people that Indigenous people were doing or have done in the past or might even be doing in their gardens now?
Yeah.
Whether that's being looked at?
Not as far as I know, but that would be of relevance and would be interesting. And I think that is what I've noticed with the, and what we've all noticed, is the conferences now start usually with some consideration of the deeper history of the country, and that will be by a local Indigenous person talking about that, often about the geology of the country, the age of the rocks, about the history, and they'll work their way up through to the gardens of the rich and famous at the very end. sort of, that's a caricature. But that interest, I think, and the looking at gardening, or to use that term, or gardens in an Indigenous sense, I think is an interesting, fertile area. The risk is, of course, that do you need that to be done by people, community, of community? It's very hard to do that as a Westerner. But
I suppose there are people who could be asked or, interested or drawn to do collaborations or whatever.
Yeah. I think that's
various,
the way
various happen. Indigenous institutes around various universities.
Yeah.
Okay. So you... You've talked about ageing gardens and the need to have intervention in them. You've talked about, bigger picture issues and your own expertise both in management and research. You've talked quite a bit about having interactions with various levels of government as well in running the gardens. Have you ever considered going into politics yourself?
I haven't. It's been suggested. No, well, not suggested to me. I do it. Suggested that people think I must be wanting to, which is perhaps a different way of putting it. Politics interests me, and I enjoy working with government. And I particularly used to enjoy in Sydney. We were a lot closer to the state government, and we worked more with ministers and their departments and their offices. I don't think I would do it because it is a difficult game, and you need to be a really strong people person. And one thing, I like talking to people, and I like talking with them to a certain extent. I'm not necessarily good at the kind of social chit chat. Or don't enjoy it, let's say. I can do it, but I don't enjoy it. And I think as a politician, you might, despite what some of them seem to be, that is something they need. So look, politics is interesting, and I haven't really ever seriously considered it. I like working at the edge of politics, and I like the political aspect of working in a botanic garden or a cultural institution, but I don't think I would get into politics.
Okay. Even if it meant that you could affect your bigger vision about gardens?
That's interesting. I mean, it's a lot of reason people do go into politics to do things, to change the world. I don't think that I would do it for that reason. It's partly the stage of career I'm at now too, and it's not where I want to be. And I think others are just as effective on it. And I don't think you would make major change in some of the things I'm interested in by being a politician. That's watching people go into politics and watching what they can do. And it just doesn't seem the ideal way, which is interesting in terms of the society again, the Australian Garden History Society, what influence it has and how much it lobbies, the politics of that society, which I haven't done a lot of. That's probably another interesting point. As a CEO, you are politically neutral and adaptable to the government of the time. You like some governments more than others, and you perhaps have your own biases. But you do need to be there for the organisation, working with whatever government's there. So you're not really trying to change things that way. You lobby in a different kind of way. So I'm probably more used to that lobbying behind the scenes than I am lobbying overtly. And, going right back to, protesting, I wasn't so much in the Franklin River or on a boat in the Franklin River. I was doing it perhaps behind the scenes, yeah.
Okay. The pen is mightier than the shovel.
Well, yeah. Yes. Sometimes it is.
If you had your time again, career-wise, would you do anything differently? Would it still relate back to gardens and garden in some sense, or to plant life in some sense?
I find that an interesting question because I don't like the kind of what ifs in history. I find that really irritating. It's a good question, but I'm just saying that when people go through history and they say, well, what if Napoleon hadn't done this, or what if he got on the ship and he came to Australia and instead of going somewhere else. And of course, you know, that would have changed everything in so many hundred thousand ways that you cannot possibly know. But to your point, I think it could be entirely different. I mean, interestingly, I think if I ran my life again, it would not have to necessarily be in plants and botany. I do think there were chance events and decisions. You know, was I going to... I loved maths for a long time, and I was really interested in pure maths. I don't like applied maths very much, but I found that fascinating. So I could see myself doing that. At the end of, I think it was my PhD, I was getting a bit tired of research, and I was really interested in journalism, and I might have applied for something and I didn't get in, but I would like, you know, I think I'd enjoy journalism to an extent, and law is another thing which I've always been intrigued by. So there are things, you know, we all have things we might have done. I feel, if I went looking back, I feel I've made a good decision because I can use botany and I can use plants and gardens to do all the other things I like. And that is writing and explaining and teaching and changing and leading and all those kind of things. I think I could transpose that. I could pop that down and do something entirely different. And whether I'd be successful, who knows? You know,
well, if you're interested in the law, I mean, there's actually nothing to stop you from doing a law degree now.
No.
You know, it doesn't have to be rewriting the past.
No.
Yeah.
No, that's right, exactly. But again, my son Jerome is a barrister, a lawyer, and I enjoy having conversations with him. I mean, he enjoys talking through cases with me, I think, and just... But then I think, well, at least I don't have to go and take them into court now and lose. You know, I can have the intellectual conversation. And I think it's interesting, the journalism one's interesting, because I don't... Looking at what a journalist's life is like and that writing pressures and the deadlines, I don't actually think I would like that much. And I like setting my own deadlines, and I keep them, as we've talked about, and I'm really precise on that, but I like setting them myself, and that's what you can do as a CEO usually. But as a journalist, it would be set by somebody else. So I do think it's an ideal arrangement where I can write for magazines and op-eds and do radio and things, but my day job was as a botanic gardens director. That, in a way, you know, as you say, would I do it differently? I think that's turned out to be a great mix.
Yes, it's clear through your memoir that you've always managed to be a science communicator at the same time. I mean, the two parts of your career seem to have meshed, that you've used your position in order to get out a message in a way that a journalist would hope to get out a message anyway.
Yeah, and that, it means being an essential part of the job for me. I don't think I would do it without that, and it is a great opportunity to do that, or a chance to do that. And I suppose it's people can do it in different ways. And I don't think every director of a botanic garden or every director of a cultural institution has to be the same. And you can do it without that. But for me, that makes it all work.
Okay. I think I've asked all the questions that I wanted to ask. Is there anything else that I haven't touched on that you'd like to leave on record?
Let me think. We've covered the background really well, thank you, and the society. I should have mentioned that I'm the patron of the Australian Garden History Society, which is something I've been since 2018, and I don't quite know how that came about, but it's possibly through some of those people I mentioned earlier on, and I think Richard Heathcote might have been the president at that time, and they were looking around for a new patron, and I'm the patron of a few different organisations, including I've been a patron of a cactus and succulent societies in New South Wales and Victoria, a thing called Fungi Map, a citizen science program, Mossman Botanic Garden in Queensland, and a thing called Plant Trust. So I mention those partly because I think it's good to have them on. Oh, one other one is the Friends of the Ballarat Botanical Gardens. I mention them because it's another role, being a head of a botanic garden and being able to be a patron of these places, where you don't have don't spend a lot of time on each of those, but it does. You sometimes go to general meetings, you might give a talk, you might present things, or you might give advice, And I've quite liked those roles. So being with the Australian Garden History Society as a patron has been a lovely role. And that means I write an introduction to the meetings, their conferences, often in their little booklet. I'll give it a talk, and I've spoken about some of the talks I give. And it also means, and I should mention, Linda. My wife, Linda's become a member of the Victorian chapter. So about a year after I became patron, we were in New Zealand, and she became became involved in being part of the regional committee that looks after Victoria as a newsletter editor. And that's been great too. That's actually worked for both of us too, both having an interest in gardens, and Linda has a botanical background as well as French teaching. So that's also, I found, quite a nice way for that to fit into our lives. If you're, you know, having that common interest, we've always had a common botanical interest. And I think if I looked at the society, the only other thing to mention is getting involved in some of the tours that they lead around Victoria, being able to keep giving talks to them if I can, and that opportunity to, you know, going right back to where I started, to be able to provoke, it might have been through book reviews initially, but now I can do it through giving talks. So I've evolved from having to do it subtly through book reviews to now being overt in talks.
Okay. That's it? Well, then I think I should finish by thanking you for taking part, giving your time to doing this, and I'll turn the recording off and explain to you some of the subsequent practicalities and administration that will follow on.